Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills, accelerate your team's impact, and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
Hey guys, this right here is going to be the ACLS section over tachycardia and bradycardia. Just keep in mind that with bradycardia, not everyone who's bradycardic is pathological. You have your athletes that can have heart rates in the 50s and 40s. I am not someone you would look at and be like, oh, he's the peak of human performance, or he is an Olympian. But I do try to keep up with myself, and my resting heart rate while I'm sitting is around the 50s, and when I am asleep, it is usually in the low 40s. So, you know, that right there is an example. But again, there's not very many reasons why someone should be tachycardic unless they are exercising. There's really no like super duper athlete that can sustain a heart rate of 220. That does not exist. So you're definitely going to be treating that. But for bradycardia, again, just remember your athletes and your well-conditioned people, they can be bradycardic with no symptoms. So just kind of knowing when to use your percutaneous pacing for those patients, or when to give adenosine, and how to give adenosine for those super tachy arrhythmias is going to be kind of the big takeaway for this particular chapter or this particular section of the ACLS handbook. So I hope that you guys enjoy the AHA's ACLS section of tachycardia and bradycardia from the ACLS provider manual.
Oh boy, got some blood going.
Yeah, blood.
He's wearing it too.
Welcome to the bay. When you get over to the bed, we'll go ahead and give you the story. This is all going to happen super fast. Welcome to the emergency room.
70-year-old female, single driver of a vehicle. Appearance that she went off-road into a ditch, rolled over her car onto a trailer, caved in, the top of the vehicle was caved in, so she was hanging out partially from the window.
We have 45 minutes of CPR.
Welcome to the deep dive. Today we have a really clear, almost surgical objective, you could say. Mm-hmm. We are skipping the huge stack of protocols and really performing a precision dive into ACLS advanced cardiovascular life support.
Right.
Specifically, we're using that 80-20 idea for the high yield stuff, those critical rhythms where the patient actually still has a pulse.
Yeah, that's key.
Our goal is simple. Give you the 20% of knowledge, the decision points, the exact doses, the traps that really drive 80% of your success, whether it's for the exam or, you know, right there on the ER floor.
And that focus is just so essential. A lot of folks, learners, even experienced providers, can get really bogged down trying to memorize every single rhythm variation out there.
Totally.
But when you boil ACLS down, especially these protocols for patients with a pulse, the whole decision tree hangs on one thing. Mm. Is the patient stable or unstable?
Right.
If we can just lock down how to spot instability, everything else kind of falls into place. It tells you whether you need pads for shocking or pacing or a specific drug.
Okay, so let's unpack that and really set the foundation. We're dealing with two main problems today. The patient's heart rate is either too slow, that's bradycardia, or too fast tachycardia.
Correct.
But the starting point for figuring out what to do, it's actually the same for both. What is the one absolutely critical thing we look for that tells us we have to act right now?
Yeah, and it's not just the number on the monitor, the heart rate itself. It's the proof, the evidence of poor perfusion to vital organs. We've got to stop staring at the screen and actually look at the patient.
Good point.
So we talk about symptomatic bradycardia, usually being a rate under 50, generally speaking. And symptomatic tachycardia, often over 100, but really it's rates over maybe 150 that tend to cause the instability. The key word is symptomatic. The rate is causing serious problems.
And how do we define the serious problems?
Okay, so to cut right through the noise, you need to basically memorize what we call the five hallmarks of instability.
Mm-hmm.
Cold. If a patient has a slow rhythm or a fast one and shows any one of these five signs, you've got seconds, maybe minutes, tops, to act. These mandate aggressive steps like pacing for slow rates or synchronized cardioversion for fast ones.
Okay, what are they?
Number one, hypotension, symptomatic low blood pressure.
Okay.
Two, acutely altered mental status, or AMS. That means a sudden change, they're not acting right.
Okay.
Three, signs of shock. You know, cool, clammy skin, poor capillary refill, that whole picture.
Right.
Four, ischemic chest discomfort. We're talking active cardiac chest pain here.
Mm-hmm.
And five, acute heart failure. Think sudden severe difficulty breathing, maybe crackles in the lungs, that sort of thing.
Okay. Hypotension, shock signs, chest pain, heart failure signs. Those seem pretty clear. But that acutely altered mental status, let's clarify, we don't just mean someone's a bit drowsy.
No, absolutely not. We mean a patient who was, say, talking to you fine 5 minutes ago, and now they're confused, maybe unresponsive, can't follow simple commands. It's because their brain isn't getting enough oxygenated blood flow.
So the heart rate issue is directly causing brain dysfunction.
Exactly. The unstable patient is crashing. Their pressure is often tanking because the heart's either not filling properly or not pumping effectively. And the brain feels that first. That altered mental status is a huge red flag that the rhythm problem is causing systemic failure right now.
Okay, so if we spot one of those five signs, the clock is ticking hard, but we can't just blindly grab a drug or the paddles, right? Before any of that, what are those basic universal steps, a BLS bedrock, that we have to do first?
Yeah, those basics are your safety net.
Yeah.
You absolutely have to maintain a patent airway, make sure they can breathe, assist their breathing if needed, give oxygen if their hypoxemic saturation below 94%.
Okay.
And while you're doing that, or someone else's, get IV access immediately. You need that line ready before you need to push critical drugs. Skipping the basics, especially airway and breathing, means even the perfect algorithm execution is going to fail. Monitor rhythm, BP, pulse ox too, obviously.
Right. ABCs plus monitor and IV. Now let's walk through those simplified decision paths using those five instability signs as our guide.
Perfect.
Path A, bradycardia with poor perfusion. So the patient's unstable, heart rate usually under 50. We've got our IV in. Looking at the adult bradycardia algorithm, what's the first chemical we reach for and why?
First line is always atropine, assuming there aren't specific contraindications we'll touch on later.
Okay.
It's the go-to for symptomatic bradycardia because it works quickly to block the vagus nerve, which usually speeds up the SA node firing rate and can improve conduction through the AD node, provided the block isn't too low down.
And the dose?
The dose is 1 milligram IV bolus. And you can repeat that.
Okay, 1 milligram.
Yeah.
But atropine isn't always the fix, right? What's the high-yield backup plan? What if we push that first milligram and the heart rate doesn't respond, or maybe the blood pressure is still dropping? We have to escalate fast.
Absolutely. If that first dose of atropine is ineffective, or if the block is clearly below the AV node, like a Mobitz 2 or third degree, you need to immediately start preparing for transcutaneous pacing, or TCP.
Yeah, immediately.
Yes. Cannot stress this enough. Don't waste precious time giving repeat atropine doses if the first one did nothing and the patient is clearly unstable. TCP is the treatment for hemodynamically unstable bradycardia that doesn't respond to atropine.
Okay, so while someone's getting the pacer pads on and setting it up, is there anything else we can do? A bridge?
Yes, exactly. While you or your team is getting the TCP ready, placing pads, setting the rate, figuring out the energy needed, you can bridge with an infusion. That's where epinephrine or dopamine comes in.
Oh, okay.
The epinephrine infusion usually starts at 2 to 10 micrograms per minute. This buys you critical time until that pacer is actually capturing and working.
Let's talk about that pacing for a second. TCP, it works, but it's not pleasant for the patient, right? Because you're essentially sending electricity through their chest wall. What's the really important practical point here?
Sedation and analgesia. It's crucial. The guidelines are very clear. Unless the patient is totally unresponsive or actively coding, transcutaneous pacing is painful. You really should provide pain relief and sedation before you start, or right as you start, if possible.
Think so.
The goal with TCP is to set the rate, usually somewhere between 60 and 80 beats per minute, and then dial up the milliamps, the energy, just until you achieve electrical capture. You see a pacing spike, followed by a QRS, and more importantly, mechanical capture, meaning you can feel a pulse that matches the paced rate. But trying to pace a conscious person without sedation, well, it's just adding unnecessary trauma.
Right. Okay, good point. Now let's switch gears. Path B, tachycardia. Heart rate is too fast. This is where things get really interesting because the immediate action often shifts from drugs to electricity.
Mm-hmm.
So if the rate is typically up over 150 beats per minute and they have any of those five instabilities, so we talked about hypotension, AMS, shock, chest pain, heart failure, what is the absolute non-negotiable first action?
Immediate synchronized cardioversion.
Full stop. No hesitation.
No hesitation. If they are unstable due to the tachycardia, you do not wait. You don't wait for labs. You don't try giving adenosine first. You synchronize the monitor to the R wave and deliver the appropriate energy shock immediately. Speed is absolutely critical here.
Okay, immediate synchronized shock for unstable tachycardia. But before we talk about the drugs for stable tachycardia, there's a huge trap here, right? When should you absolutely not cardiovert someone, even if their heart rate is, say, 180?
Yes, absolutely critical distinction. You never, ever cardiovert sinus tachycardia.
Why not?
Because sinus tach isn't the cause of the problem, it's a result. It's the heart's appropriate compensatory response to some other underlying issue. Maybe they're bleeding internally, maybe they have a fever, maybe they're septic, severely dehydrated, or in a lot of pain.
Oh, okay.
If you shock sinus tachycardia, yeah, you might momentarily stop the rhythm, but you haven't fixed the underlying reason the heart needed to beat fast. So the sinus tach will just come right back, because the body still needs to compensate. You have to find and treat the cause of the sinus tach.
Got it. Treat the cause, not the number. Okay, so now let's pivot. What if the patient is too fast, but they're stable, they're alert, talking, BP is okay, no chest pain? Now we have a little time to think about drugs. Let's really drill down on the key meds we've mentioned.
Okay, let's start with the one for bradycardia again, atropine. We said the dose is 1 milligram IV bolus. You can repeat that every 3 to 5 minutes.
Right.
But there's a maximum. The total dose you should give is 3 milligrams. That 3 milligram total is a classic test question. Going beyond that usually doesn't help and might even cause problems.
Okay, atropine 1 milligram, max of 3 milligrams total. And what about that epinephrine infusion we use as a bridge for unstable bradycardia?
Right, the EpiDrip. The dose range is typically 2 to 10 micrograms per minute, and you adjust it, you titrate it based on the patient's response, blood pressure, heart rate. But remember, it's usually just a temporary measure, buying time until you can get definitive pacing going.
Good reminder. Okay, now for the fast rhythms. Specifically, the patient is stable, but they have a regular narrow QRS tachycardia. Think SVT, supraventricular tachycardia. What's the drug that gives them that controlled near-death experience for a second?
Yeah, that's adenosine. And you absolutely have to know the sequence for this one.
Okay.
First dose. 6 milligrams CACE pushed rapidly, like slamming in, followed immediately by a 20 millilitre saline flush.
Rapid push, 6 milligrams flush.
Right. If that doesn't convert the rhythm back to sinus within a minute or two, then you give a second dose. 12 milligrams Frevi, again, rapid push, immediate flush.
12 milligrams a second time. No, when you say rapid push, how fast is rapid? Like over a few seconds or?
No, like as fast as you can physically push that syringe plunger. Mm. 1 to 2 seconds max. You want that entire dose hitting the AV node almost simultaneously.
Why so fast?
Because adenosine has an incredibly short half-life, literally just seconds. If you push it slowly, it gets metabolized in the bloodstream before it even reaches the heart muscle effectively. It won't build up enough concentration at the AV node to cause that temporary block needed to break the reentrant SVT circuit. You'll just give the patient that awful flushed chest pressure feeling without fixing the rhythm.
Wow. Okay. Rapid push is key. Got it. And finally, what about the stable patient who presents with a wide QRS tachycardia? Assuming it looks regular, we often treat it initially as ventricular tachycardia until proven otherwise.
Right. For stable, wide complex tachycardia,
yeah,
often presumed to be monomorphic VT, amiodarone is a common go-to antiarrhythmic.
Okay. Amiodarone dose.
The loading dose is 150 milligrams IV, but this one is given slowly over 10 minutes, not a rapid push like adenosine.
Okay, 150 over 10 minutes.
Correct. And that's typically followed immediately by a maintenance infusion, usually 1 milligram per minute for the first 6 hours to help prevent recurrence. So don't mix up the slow loading bolus with the maintenance drip rate.
150 over 10, then 1 per minute. Got it. This brings up a really important point. Looking at the guidelines and maybe real world experience, where do providers tend to make mistakes? What are the big traps hidden in these algorithms?
Yeah, the contraindications and the when not to use rules are definitely high risk areas for error. Let's talk about the atropine trap again.
Okay.
We mentioned it briefly, but you really must not rely on atropine for high-degree AV blocks, specifically Mobitz type 2 or third-degree AV block, especially if the QRS complex is wide.
Why not? If the heart's slow, seems logical to try atropine first.
Because those types of blocks, Mobitz 2 and third degree, particularly with the wide QRS, the problem, the block, is usually below the AV node in the His-Purkinje system.
Ah.
Cool. Atropine works mainly at or above the AV node by blocking vagal tone, so it's unlikely to help if the block is lower down. Giving atropine in this situation is often just ineffective, it wastes critical time, and in some rare cases, it can even paradoxically slow the ventricular escape rate or worsen things.
So what do you do?
If you see or strongly suspect a Mobitz, tubus, second, or third degree block, especially wide complex, you need to move directly and quickly to preparing for transcutaneous pacing. Don't delay with ineffective atropine. And one more absolute, do not use atropine situation, unstable bradycardia in a heart transplant patient.
Why is that?
Their transplanted hearts are denervated, the vagus nerve connection is severed. Atropine won't work as intended and can sometimes cause paradoxical heart rate slowing or even provoke dangerous rhythms like VFib. It's listed as a class 3 harm recommendation, meaning definitely avoid it. Pacing is the way to go there too, or maybe an EpiDrip.
Wow. Okay, that's critical to note. Now, what about the tachycardia trap? You mentioned something about irregular wide complex tachycardia.
Yes, this is a huge one. If a patient is stable but presents with an irregular wide complex tachycardia, the classic scenario you worry about is atrial fibrillation occurring in someone who also has an accessory pathway, like Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome or WPW.
Okay, AFib with WPW.
Then a whole class of drugs becomes essentially poison. You must avoid all AV nodal blocking agents.
Which drugs are those again?
That means absolutely no adenosine, no beta blockers like metoprolol, no calcium channel blockers like diltiazem or verapamil, and no digoxin.
Why are they so dangerous in this specific situation?
Because in WPW, you have the normal AV node pathway plus this extra electrical shortcut, the accessory pathway. If you give a drug that blocks or slows conduction down the normal AV node,
you force all the rapid atrial impulses down the fast accessory pathway instead.
Exactly. And that accessory pathway often doesn't have the same speed limit the AV node does. So you can suddenly accelerate the ventricular rate dramatically, potentially pushing them into ventricular fibrillation. You've inadvertently made things much, much worse.
Yikes. So what do you use for irregular wide complex tachycardias if you suspect WPW?
If they're unstable, synchronized cardioversion is still the answer. If they're stable, you'd consider antiarrhythmics that don't primarily block the AV node, like procainamide or amiodarone, often after consulting cardiology or an expert. But definitely avoid those nodal blockers.
That's fantastic clinical context. Okay, that leads perfectly into our last big decision point. Electricity. When we do decide to shock someone with a pulse, what's the difference between synchronized and unsynchronized?
It's all about timing. Synchronized cardioversion is what we use for organized tachycardias that still have a pulse.
Mm-hmm.
Think SVT, atrial fibrillation, atrial flutter, or regular monomorphic VT.
Okay.
The synchronized part means the machine looks for the R wave of the QRS complex and deliberately delivers the shock on the R wave. This avoids shocking during the relative refractory period, the T wave, which could potentially induce VFib, the dreaded R on T phenomenon.
Got it. Sync prevents VFib. So when do we use an unsynchronized shock?
Unsynchronized shock, also called defibrillation, is used mainly when there is no pulse. So for ventricular fibrillation, VFib, or pulseless ventricular tachycardia, PVT.
Makes sense. No pulse, no R wave to sync to anyway.
Exactly. Or you might use it for polymorphic VT, even if a pulse is briefly present, because the rhythm is so chaotic and disorganized that the machine might not be able to reliably identify R waves to synchronize with, and delaying the shock is dangerous. Basically, unsynchronized is for pulseless arrests or highly unstable chaotic rhythms where immediate energy delivery is paramount.
Perfect. Okay, this feels like a good place for the two-minute drill. You're standing outside the exam room or you're about to start a shift. What are the five absolute must-know instant recall facts from today?
All right, lock these in. One, the instability rule. See any of those five signs, hypotension, AMS, shock, chest pain, acute heart failure. The answer is electricity. Fast tachycardia equals immediate synchronized cardioversion. Slow bradycardia, immediate pacing if atropine fails or is contraindicated. Don't mess around with drugs first if they're truly unstable.
Got it. Instability means electricity.
Two, atropine's ceiling. Max total dose is 3 milligrams. Remember that number?
3 milligrams. Check.
Three, adenosine speed and target. Only for regular narrow complex SVT. Push it fast, 6 milligrams rapid push, then 12 milligrams rapid push, both followed by a flush. Speed is everything.
Fast, regular, narrow, 6, then 12. Okay.
4. The wide complex block bypass. If you see a Mobitz type 2 or a third degree AV block, especially with a wide QRS, your brain needs to skip right past atropine and think transcutaneous pacing immediately.
High degree block, think pace, not atropine.
Right. And 5. Pre-excitation protection. Never, ever give AV nodal blocking drugs, adenosine, beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, digoxin to someone with an irregular wide complex tachycardia. You risk inducing VFib if it's AFib with WPW. Use other agents or shock if unstable.
Avoid nodal blockers and irregular wide tachy. Got it. That was an amazing deep dive. We really cut past the fluff and focused squarely on those high stakes, high yield decisions for rhythms with a pulse.
Yeah. And remember, mastering this part of ACLS isn't really about memorizing a giant list of drugs. It's about instantly recognizing those 5 instability criteria. That recognition is your shortcut. It tells you which path to take right away.
So the big takeaway, next time you're reviewing these algorithms or maybe even facing a real situation, ask yourself first, can I name those 5 signs of instability off the top of my head?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you can do that, you've basically mastered the most critical decision point in these entire ACLS pulse pathways.
Absolutely. That's the key.
Thanks for diving deep with us today. Keep that learning momentum going.